Monster Man, special episode, Doctor Who Monsters.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games.
Today's episode is a special episode brought to you by the generosity of my Patreon supporters, and in particular, the generosity of patron Andrew Clark. If you'd like to be like Andrew and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And there, in addition to the rewards that patrons at other levels get, you'll also get the chance to nominate a monster for a special episode. And as this episode demonstrates, it can be anything. So Andrew, thank you very much, and I hope you enjoy your episode. Andrew's asked me to talk about using Doctor Who monsters in D&D, and I'm going to expand that to fantasy roleplaying in general. I think there's a surprising amount to say about this topic. Before we start, I should say that I don't know very much about the new Doctor Who, the 21st century Doctor Who. I have seen, you know, I've seen a certain amount of it. I stopped watching after a few years. I did watch the first couple years, and then, like, subsequently I have seen, you know, an episode here, an episode there, but I haven't really kept up with it. So there are some good adaptable monsters from that era, and, you know, if we have time, we'll talk about one or two of them, but I'm going to focus my attention mainly on Classic Who. I actually used to have a podcast about Classic Doctor Who. I recorded it together with my old friend Jesse Merlin. It was called Pledge Break, and we talked about the history of Doctor Who and how history is presented in Doctor Who, and it was a lot of fun, but because it was very long and it was a two-hander, the technical demands were really high, for me anyway. I'm not like a great editor, and it took me a really long time to edit it, and then we had some trouble syncing up our schedules, but I do still have most of, or I say still have, we actually lost. The Libsyn feed got lost when I forgot to update my card details for the host, but fortunately Alert Fans saved most of the episodes. So it could come back someday, but the problem is just when to do it. Anyway, I'm going to draw on some of that to answer this question today, so big thanks to Jesse for helping with that. I think Doctor Who and D&D is unlikely to ever really cross over as a podcast, but who knows, maybe there's demand out there. Okay, first off, I want to do the controversial thing and rule out the classic Doctor Who monster, the Daleks. They're the first Doctor Who monster, they're the best known Doctor Who monster, and they're not really very adaptable to a fantasy role-playing game, and that is mainly because they are so essentially science fictional. You know, Terry Nation often incorporated a lot of kind of ecological themes into his work. He wrote creatures a lot of the time. He wrote plots a lot of the time that were about the nature of modern society, modern warfare, people's relationship to science. And those just don't translate very well into fantasy settings. You'd think that they would, right? You could just kind of go, oh, well, you know, war is universal. For science, we'll just say magic. But in practice, I don't think that they do. I think you can maybe use them in the loosest possible sense, where you can say, well, these are people who have been, you know, horribly warped by their environment, and that their environment has sort of made them into these remorseless killers. But again, I think the bare fact of being a remorseless killer is less, you know, is less threatening in a Dungeons & Dragons scenario than it is in Doctor Who, where the assumption in Doctor Who is that the characters are not the kind of people who can fight their way out of situations. New Who did go a little further in making Daleks just, like, unstoppably physically powerful. That wasn't so much always the case in the classic series. You know, it was more that they were not up against the kind of people who could bring enormous amounts of firepower to bear. Typically, there are exceptions. We can say the same thing about, for example, the Autons, right? The Autons are monsters who are focused on ideas of commercialism. Classically, they frighten people by being, you know, modern objects that come to life and kill. And they play on this kind of fear of the sort of unnaturalness of plastic items, right? The image of the department store window mannequin smashing its way out of the glass and attacking passersby works really well because there is already something creepy about department store window mannequins. The closest equivalent in Dungeons & Dragons would be something like a gargoyle, where there's already something creepy about these architectural decorations. What if they were actual monsters? One of the key elements of a lot of Doctor Who, particularly I think of the modern series and the show in the 70s, is the juxtaposition of the familiar with the uncanny. So even adventures into bizarre environments are grounded by the human relatability of Ian and Barbara, or Ben and Polly, or Sarah Jane Smith, or whoever it might be. Now, that change, that formula was not always true, but it is pretty commonplace for the Doctor to have a very normal person with him whose kind of everyday perspective is meant to help highlight how weird the situations they find themselves in are. That can be done better or worse, of course. And that's something that you're not going to get in Dungeons & Dragons, where the characters themselves are frequently weird. The weirdness of the character is used for contrast in Doctor Who. So when the Doctor is weird, that is often contrasted against the non-weirdness of the companion. And it's not something that's really available to you in a D&D game. Although, at the low end of kind of old-school gaming, I think it is true. So if you're playing, you know, Dungeons & Crawl Classics, that kind of like O-level funnel, and you're all shepherds and candle makers and what have you, then I think there may be something there, but I don't think so, because even what is familiar to those characters is unfamiliar to us as the viewers. Pertwee's famous dictum that a Yeti in the Himalayas isn't that frightening, but that a Yeti in your house in Tooting is, doesn't work, because there is no familiar home, there is no Tooting. You know, there is no ordinary everyday for us to contrast these monsters with. So a whole load of monsters that use that as their core horror aren't going to fly, right? A lot of the time, classic Who can just get away with juxtaposing generic sci-fi alien with Britain in the 70s. And that isn't going to work. There are some monsters that I think do work when you boil them down to their absolute core concepts. I think one example of this would be the Cybermen. The horror of the Cybermen comes from two sources. The first is that they're the usual merciless killing machines, and there is something particularly ruthless and cruel about them. That's because they don't have any kind of finer feelings. They say that they got rid of them. This is weird because Cybermen are not particularly logical. They're the usual fist-clenching would-be world conquerors. But never mind that. Later elaborations of the Cyberman mythos, and again, this is something that was kind of undercut in the new series, I think, you know, detrimentally. The thing about the Cybermen that's particularly horrible is that they did this to themselves. They did it voluntarily. To survive in harsh environments, they voluntarily replaced their vulnerable, you know, meat bits with robot bits. And they also got rid of their finer feelings. They also got rid of sympathy and compassion, because those they felt were weaknesses. And I think we can certainly all see that there are people who believe, or at least profess to believe, that compassion is weakness. Now, the Cybermen are, in their sort of most famous story, they are most closely linked to the idea of undeath. I'm talking, of course, about Tomb of the Cybermen, which is structured very like a mummy film, right? It's about a bunch of archaeologists who go exploring the tomb, and then the tomb's guardians awaken and wreak terrible vengeance on them. And in fact, the guy who plays the backer of the expedition at Tomb of the Cybermen was also in The Hammer, The Mummy. And you know, that's not an original insight. Like, that's something that's been pointed out many times. But I do think that you can go back and make the Cybermen make sense as undead. What I mean by that is, if you think about what it means to be undead, there are quite a lot of advantages. You don't need to eat, you don't need to breathe, you don't need to drink, you don't need to sleep. You're hard to kill. If you are from a group or a culture that has access to the kinds of spells that make people undead, you know, it is not a strange idea to reach adulthood, maybe have some kids, and then arrange to have yourself turned into a white or a skeleton warrior. You don't want to be a regular skeleton or a zombie, but if you can retain some of your faculties, you're better off, with a few caveats, right? I mean, it's probably not good for the old moral alignment. I mean, sure, you'd be vulnerable to being turned by a cleric, but like, a living person's vulnerable to being shot with arrows, which is much more common. There's a good example of this, I think, actually, in the novel, the Black Iron books, the second one. I can't remember which one's the Gutter Prayer and which one's the Shadow Saint. I want to say the Gutter Prayer is the first one and the Shadow Saint's the second one, but whichever one is the second, there's a culture where undeath is just part of their society. And there are like different levels of undeath that are sort of correlate to your status in society and your relationship with the, you know, the ruling class and the religion. So I think that the Cybermen, if we were to move them into Dungeons and Dragons, we wind up with an analogous civilization who looked around and saw the world with its sunlight and love and affection and thought, you know, this is not really efficient. If I really wanted to take vengeance on my enemies, if I really wanted to ensure my kingdom's dominance, if I really wanted to efficiently achieve my goals, as long as those goals weren't about empathy or compassion or pleasure or joy, the best thing for me would be to be undead. There's a horror to the idea that they did it to themselves. This, incidentally, is why Stuart Gordon's Dagon loses some of the visceral impact of H.P. Lovecraft's The Shadow of Rinsmith. I realize this is a complete digression, because in Dagon, the Deep Ones are something that the villagers in Innsmouth inflict on other people. And it's very easy to imagine that people are willing to disregard other people's humanity for personal gain. But the horror of Shadow over Innsmouth is that these people disregard their own humanity for personal gain. That they made this, to them, rational choice. Anyway, that's a digression. So I think the Cybermen can work as long as they're able to present the choice to become undead as a perfectly reasonable one. We made the smart choice. Look at us now. We're better than you are. We're stronger. We live forever. I think that there's a lot to be said about it, and particularly interesting because it kind of mimics the language with which gamers often talk about choosing character concepts. Halfling rogues are great, but in general, they're not as good as elf rogues because elf rogues can see in the dark. You know, you look for these mechanical advantages. That's kind of the way that we as players sometimes speak about these options. We never think like, oh, halfling rogues, they have a good time. Look, I played a halfling rogue. I'm not trying to say that I'm one of these people, but like, admit those thoughts are there, right? So it'd be interesting to have a society who had those thoughts within the bounds of the game. The other monsters that are easy to translate over are those that simply pose some kind of ethical quandary. The obvious example of these are the Silurians. The Silurians are violent jerks, but they're also kind of right. They are the original inhabitants of the planet, and they woke up to find that mammals had taken over and they want their planet back. Okay, you know, they're maybe not thrilled about their methods. Maybe none of the people that they're hurting personally had anything to do with mammalian life displacing the dinosaurs. But at the same time, you can sort of understand why they'd be upset. You know, is it ethical to just slaughter them all? But there are a number of monsters that are like that, that essentially could fit neatly into a fantasy setting because the ethical concerns that they present are not specifically science fictional. Some monsters don't work because they are fantastic elements in a non-fantastic world. That is to say that there are quite a lot of monsters that don't function, partly because in Doctor Who they appear in a world where belief in the supernatural is not commonplace. So examples of this would be like the Peladon stories. I'm really just picking all John Pertwee stories, huh? I mean, Tomb of the Cybermen's a Patrick Troughton story. But I feel like they're good examples. You know, if you do the Peladon stories, the first one at least, a big part of it is that these people are going missing and everyone's speculating who, like, the killers are, and some people are like, ooh, it's Agador, and then some people are like, don't be stupid, Agador's a myth. That's never going to happen in a D&D game. You're not going to run into a society where people are like, bugbears? There's no such thing. So, although Agador is otherwise a good example of a monster, like, because he's kind of cute and fun, you know? He's like a big hairy beast, but if you sing him a lullaby and be his friend, he's dangerous, but he's not evil. Or like Horns of the Nymon, where for some reason Soldeed doesn't think that the Nymon are interplanetary conquerors, even though that's like the most obvious thing that they would be. You know, his explanation is less plausible. I'm sorry for bringing in Horns of the Nymon. I understand it is not a widely regarded story. I just love the way that dude wanders around the corridors going, Nymon, Lord Nymon, it is I, Soldeed. I haven't seen that in a long time, so that may not be a very good Soldeed impression, but kind of talks like that. So monsters like this that rely on the tension between fantasy and reality, or fantasy and science fiction, aren't going to work because this game doesn't have either reality or science fiction, right? No D&D campaign is set in a world where people don't think monsters are real, right? Even games that are set in something closer to an analog for Earth's Middle Ages are based on a world where people do think the monsters are real, they're just mostly not.
There are a couple of stories that I do think translate quite neatly into a certain type of gonzo D&D scenario. A great example of this would be the Peter Davison story Terminus. So Terminus is about a group of characters exploring a large but bounded environment full of hazards and potentially monsters that is occupied by several different factions, each with their own competing agendas, all of which are under threat by, a major kind of external plot, even though they don't all realize that. Sound familiar? It is basically a space dungeon, and it's a space dungeon full of, like, very gonzo D&D stuff, so, like, drug addict Viking warrior guys, and a big dog mutant who's actually a highly intelligent doctor, but just everybody's scared of him because he's, like, a big, fat dog. It's not actually a super effective monster costume, but the idea is that he's this big, hideous, powerful monster. There are some dumb elements, like the plot turning on a lever that's stuck. You know, we need the big dog to throw the lever because it sticks a bit. And stuff like that, but in general, I think structurally it is a pretty good dungeon idea, even if the actual narrative does involve sidelining some of the characters because someone thought it'd be a good idea to have a ton of companions in the TARDIS and then forgot that actually that's quite hard to write effectively. But I think that that's an example of a story that translates quite neatly. In order to answer this question, I went down a big list of Doctor Who monsters, and it is really remarkable how many of them are frankly forgettable. So, I have definitely seen the Dominators, but I couldn't tell you what, like, the Dominators' deal is. They're just kind of mean people, and there are a lot of monsters where the visual design is what's really interesting about them. Like the Candyman of the Happiness Patrol. Actually, you know, now that I say that, Candyman of the Happiness Patrol could kind of appear in, you know, a sort of gonzo OSR dungeon. I'm not saying that it would make sense in Blood and the Chocolate, but we've got a special episode coming up about other kinds of golem. And if you said, yeah, he's a sugar golem, you know, he's a candy golem. And, you know, there is a tradition of medieval cooks kind of making weird stuff out of sugar. So-called sugar feasts were often more like kind of art gallery displays, but all the different things that they could make essentially out of kind of spun sugar. I think there's maybe something there. As a symbol of a society that is luxurious and decadent, it works really well. In Happiness Patrol, it's all about sort of like sweetness, like it's sweet but it kills, a bit like the enforced happiness of the Happiness Patrol setting. And that doesn't actually work all that well because it's not going to translate to Dungeons & Dragons effectively. But I think you could bring in Candyman, yeah? The Licorice Golem? You're bringing in a note of fairy tale stuff that, you know, now you're going to have that. Like, you can't go back from it. But with a few exceptions like that, a lot of Doctor Who monsters don't kind of have that much going for them. They're either just sort of people, or they're really only cool because of their visual design. Like, the Voords from The Keys of Marinus look amazing. Just fantastic photograph. But, like, that's it. They're just the bad guys. And then a lot of the rest of them are just mad despot, militaristic would-be world conqueror. And then a lot of the other ones are a creature from Earth's mythology explained as an alien, which is something that you can't really do in a Dungeons & Dragons game. So I think you have to kind of look for the monsters whose strengths do translate. And that is, I mentioned first, you know, monsters that have some kind of ethical conflict or quandary at the heart of them, and we can include things like the undead Cyberman in that. Monsters that, if stripped of their science fictional trappings, are still an interesting society. You could maybe even include something like the Centaurans in that, although the deal there is just that they're kind of bullheadedly militaristic. I mean, they're kind of hobgoblins. But you can't have the ones that are ultimately about modern questions or about their contrast with modern society. One thing that Doctor Who does really well is jarring juxtapositions. And I don't know how possible this is to convey in a game. Maybe some kind of like gonzo over the top ultraviolet grasslands kind of environment it might work. And certainly in a post-apocalyptic game, something like Gamma World, a lot of these ideas would work because they rely on the combination of ideas that would not otherwise be combined. So one of the episodes that Jesse and I covered for Pledge Break was the episode The King's Demons. And it's not any good. I mean, it's pretty bad. It's Peter Davison's story. Not very much goes on in it. There's a bunch of rigmarole and running around and some stuff about Magna Carta. I mean, it's kind of a big bunch of nothing. Well, it's quite a small bunch of nothing, actually. But it has this scene where King John is sitting playing a song about going on crusade and how he's going to put the heathen to the sword.
And while he's doing that, like a flickering aura comes over him, and he turns out instead to be a shape-shifting robot. So it's a shape-shifting robot playing a lute and singing a song about going on crusade in 13th century England. And I think we can all agree that, good or bad though that story may have been, and it was bad, that's not something that you would find on any other television show. There's no other show that's going to have that in it. And there's a certain delight in the gonzo bricolage of these stories. And when it's done well, it tells you something about what happens when you combine these ideas, and when it's done badly, it's the Masque of Mandragora. But there's a charm to that that I think you can make something out of, even if you remove the thing from its original context. Again, if you do that all the time, that's going to become what your game is about, and it loses some of its impact. But I think here and there, there's room for that kind of particularly Whovian wackiness. So I guess that's an exception to my general rule about focusing on the fundamentals, which is that there are cases where you can get away with focusing on the aesthetics. And if the rush of inexplicable weirdness is good enough, you can probably get some mileage out of incorporating that thing into your game. Yeah, but for the most part, focus on the fundamentals. Ooh, I will say one other thing. Some Doctor Who monsters have established tactical gimmicks, and here I'll venture into New Who. The most obvious of these is the Weeping Angels. You could make this into quite a fun puzzle. This room is full of statues that will come to life if no one is looking at them, so therefore you have to kind of position yourself so there's always someone looking at every statue. I realize that this idea originally comes from, is it Super Mario Brothers 3, where the ghosts won't move when you're looking at them? But that's actually pretty legit, and there are a few other examples of that. So you can see this in terms of, like, Agador can be charmed by singing the lullaby, or Cybermen are vulnerable to gold, although that later became, like, a silver bullet kills a werewolf or whatever, which is not. But I think there's something to be said for a monster with a relatively simple puzzle gimmick, and the puzzles in Doctor Who, because it's intended for a younger audience, tend to be relatively simple. Sometimes that works badly, like in Pyramids of Mars, you know, but when it's done well, I do think that you get people designing monsters that were intended to be sort of solved within a relatively brief period of time. And I think that there's something to that. So I think the Weeping Angel is probably the best example. They could, in fact, be ported over without any difficulty. In fact, the only thing that prevents that is their own success. That is to say that the gimmick is now so recognizable that you couldn't use it in a game without people going, oh, I get it, it's like the Weeping Angels. So those are just some thoughts. I could go on. You know, I love Classic Who, and I love monsters. So it feels like there's a lot more to say if we really, you know, dig deep into individual stories, but hopefully that should give some ideas for, like, a good methodology to use when attempting to adapt Doctor Who monsters into a Dungeons & Dragons game. So, Andrew, I hope that you enjoyed your episode. If you'd like to be like Andrew and get your own bonus episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. In our next episode, we're going to be doing our wrap-up of Monster Manual 2, the 1983 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition, and we're going to see what, if anything, we've learned from this nonsense. That's going to be next time on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.